Blog Talk Radio.
I'm Ron Edwards, and this is the Ron and Don program coming to you this Wednesday evening from the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. We've had some beautiful weather today, rainstorm last night, but, you know, humidity shot back up. We are taking a look at the craziness of the political arena in the United States of America. How would you like to be Donald Trump Jr.? Not the dad, not the man who's the imperial president, but Donald Trump Jr., who has the same arrogance, if you will, of his brother-in-law in regards to just saying whatever they want to say about the truth, dismissing it, disregarding it, casting it out, if you will. A lot of things going on in our world. Tonight here from the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, our associate and co-host, Mr. Allen, continuing his academic endeavors and et cetera, working very hard to continue to get his degrees in order, if you will. But life goes on, the world goes on, and this program goes on, if you know what I mean. First of all, I want to take this opportunity because we, unfortunately, here in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, have a terrible problem with public safety. In an election year, also, our mayor and all city council members, all 13 of them, and a couple of other minor offices are all up for re-election or election in November of this year. And so it's been kind of interesting to watch how the politicians are dealing with the issues. Of course, the least of the issues that they deal with are issues pertaining to people of color and poor people. They really don't have a very high priority in our beloved Shangri-La, you know, my nickname for the city, you know, at the head of the Mississippi, if you will. But today, I came away from a kind of a town hall meeting at the Minneapolis Urban League. I had initially thought that It would be something that was not conducive to really talking about the problems, the threats, if you will, that are facing the African-American community and other communities of color. But first of all, after arriving at the Urban League at 2 o'clock for a meeting that lasted from 2 to 5, if you will, under the auspices of President Steve Belton of the Minneapolis Urban League, I came away, you know, once again, kind of rejuvenated, if you will. First and foremost, I had an opportunity to sit and listen to some oopsie-daisy black researchers, if you will. Keep that in mind for tonight's program, black researchers, black people who research those things which are such a threat and such a detriment to the well-being and to the future, if you will, of the sons and daughters of the African. And so when I entered the room, there was a crowd of approximately 45, if you will. Tables had been set up. The announcement that had gone out would clearly indicate that there would be, the introduction by the head of the administrative head of the Urban League, Mr. Belton. Then there would be a presentation by two eminent researchers, both black females, one a native-born American, the other one born in the African country of Cameroon, if you will, both of them on top of their game. I have to tell y'all that as we sat there as a group of Metropolitans, if you will, and listen to them talk about the threat that is current and present in the relationship between community and police, and that element of that threat, which includes mental health. Now, we have been talking on this program for a number of months about the very disturbing pattern that is taking place here in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul. And the homicides are, proportionally, we're not Chicago, I mean, you know, but as it pertains to the size of this city and what we consider to be the quality of life that we're always told about as African Americans, you would think that, you know, maybe we would have two or three homicides a year in Minneapolis, maybe two or three in St. Paul. You know what I mean? I don't think we've had that low a number since we were frontier towns back in the 1850s. Right, that you heard me right, the 1850s. And so when I became aware that these two outstanding academicians, these two outstanding researchers were going to be talking about police misconduct, police brutality, if you will. You know, we're still now in the kind of shakedown period after the Castile trial in St. Paul and the death of Orlando Castile, who died a year ago, a week ago. The officer involved from a department in a little town or a little suburb called St. Anthony was acquitted, though his department severed their relationship with him. In fact, just today, Officer Yanis signed a separation agreement, and he was awarded 1 year's back pay of a little over $48,000. Also, the city of St. Anthony and the small municipality of Falcon Heights, which is actually in Ramsey County, severed, by, I guess, mutual agreement, severed their relationship of St. Anthony providing police services to Falcon Heights. Falcon Heights was the enclave, the municipality in which Mr. Castile was shot and killed a year ago, a little over a year ago now, if you will. I think both municipalities decided that separation was the best thing, probably sooner than later, if you will. And the service being provided by St. Anthony to Falcon Heights will officially end on, according to the news accounts, the 31st day of December of this year. And so the Castile situation, all of the circumstances surrounding his tragic death, the trial, and etc. Oh, by the way, on that particular note, and kudos to Michelle Gross of the organization known as the Committee Against Police Brutality, which has been in business for over 20-some years. Ms. Gross can she can get under your skin, but she did something, and we're moving towards the excellent presentation this afternoon at the Urban League. But the Castile situation has brought so many things into play that it makes you understand that sometimes a tragedy that befalls an African-American family, an African-American individual, does have consequences as it pertains to correcting the societies, but more importantly, the institutions that allegedly protect us, provide, and all of that, when in fact those systems really don't work for us. And so with the decision to invalidate the contract, we had this very quiet announcement in the Minneapolis paper this morning that Ms. Michelle Gross, head of the Committee Against Police Brutality, has filed a ethics complaint against Earl Gray, one of the attorneys for officer, former officer Yanis, if you will, in the matter of the death of Castile. Now, what is interesting about this is that this is real weird, real weird, and is almost unprecedented, particularly in that Ms. Gross is a layperson, as they would say in the legal community. She is not an attorney, nor was she a party in any shape, form, or fashion, other than being a citizen who took note of the statutes, if you will, and that is the judiciary statutes that govern the conduct of lawyers during the course of trial or preparation for trial or other kinds of legal actions. And to some degree, the judge, who we were never at the trial, so our information was coming from people that were from the newspapers and such. Let's make that clear. Let's make that disclosure at this. Ms. Gross, who attended the trial each and every day and obviously listens and et cetera, recognized that during the voir dire that the attorney Earl Gray, who is alleged, you know, to have a reputation as a tough lawyer and et cetera, primarily knowing how to handle people of color. Well, one of the things that happened in that trial was that one of the prospective jurors was an 18-year-old Ethiopian woman of color, who had resided in the United States since she was 10 years of age. So she had been here a little over 8 years, going to college, if you will, continuing to matriculate her educational pursuits and et cetera. But I remembered when the story was written by both of the major newspapers here in the Twin Cities, and there was some reflection about how this young Ethiopian student, now a resident, and I imagine working towards her citizenship, et cetera, how she was handled, how she was talked to, how she was disrespected by the attorney Earl Gray and the defense team. But it was Earl Gray who badgered her and made references to her intellect, to her intelligence, and et cetera. And what Ms. Gross has now pointed out, for those of you that didn't know that it happened yesterday, the filing of the ethics complaint against this powerful white lawyer, was that Ms. Gross researched the law. She researched the statute. And she found a specific provision that talked in terms of, you know, a word that's oftentimes used in the judiciary is frivolous. You know, frivolous conversation, frivolous references, frivolous conduct, and et cetera. And oftentimes, the frivolousness, if you will, is handled when objections are made in the court with regards to relevance, a key a word within the operational docket, if you will, of the judiciary system. And so what Mr. Gray did is that after he had moved to excuse this young Ethiopian student, now a citizen of the United States of America, later to be identified by the presiding judge, who, by the way, was the presiding judge because the initial judge selected by appropriate process the very well-respected and most senior judge on the Ramsey County District Court bench, Edward Wilson, had been removed. And in fact, it was Mr. Bray who led the attack in the course of, you know, appropriate a protocol, judicial protocol, and et cetera, implying that Judge Wilson, though in Minnesota, you don't necessarily have to give specific and definitive declaration on why you're removing a judge, if you will. But, you know, normally an attorney, you know, makes sure that information gets out that this judge is being asked to be removed, recused, or whatever, because of some series of events, if you will, some philosophical position, though the courts about raising questions about the philosophical philosophies. I mean, unless you just, as the judge said, I love neo-Nazis, you know what I mean, or I love the Black Panthers, or you know, I love Angela Davis. Not that our Angela Davis here who's on WCCO, but I'm talking about the original Angela Davis of the 1960s, one of the true revolutionaries of that particular period. So you have to allegedly be careful about how you deal in the pursuit of the application, if you will, those things that guide you. You know, we're all guided by statutes and et cetera. In fact, they have big books et cetera that tell you how you're supposed to conduct yourself. And, you know, lawyers don't get their licenses, if you will, the right to practice law, until they have passed all the necessary tests. In fact, you know, be surprised at the number of lawyers that fail the bar, as they like to say. You know, just can't get it, man. It's a little too tough. But in the case, of course, Earl Grey, you know, Earl's been around a long time. He has some interesting relationships. He has the right connections, as we oftentimes say, tongue in cheek. See, we can, as a civilian, as a non-attorney, we can say some things on this program tonight that a fellow lawyer would have to be careful about, as it pertains to the canons, as they refer to them. Those are the articles that deal with conduct, if you will, expectations, if you will, privilege, or lack of privilege, and et cetera. So as an African-American commentator, I clearly understand what all of that means. You know what I mean? It's a heck of a thing to be privileged, like our imperial president, his son, Donald Trump Jr., people like that. But anyways, back to Ms. Gross. Ms. Gross filed an ethics complaint against old Earl, and she, I tell you, in a very definitive manner, with great specificity and detail, laid out how he violated the canons, how he violated the requirements of the Minnesota statute as it pertains to a frivolous attack upon an individual. Now, one of the things that the court stays away from is to try to, you know, keep you from going too deep with regards to why you think, if you are the complainant, why you think that these statements were made. Of course, in the case of Earl Grey, is that the statements were being made because he's a racist. In fact, his whole theme in the state of Minnesota has been a tough-talking white guy, if you will, who, as I said earlier, knows how to deal with the Negro problem. In this case, of course, the young lady is an Ethiopian, but as far as some are concerned in the elements that Mr. Gray is most associated with, she's nothing but a piece of property, has no business in the United States of America. And so what happened after he fought that he had excused her and was required to make a little bit more definitive statement, though the rules indicate that the person in question that is now being questioned to be quote-unquote eligible and, most importantly, competent to be a juror, has been asked to exit the courtroom. And then at that point, Mr. Gray, according to the copyrighted story in the Minneapolis Star Tribune today, immediately indicated that the woman was incompetent and that she had no ability to know what the heck she was talking. Now, you have to understand, this young lady is a college student now, okay, has matriculated magnificently, if you will, has actually rushed ahead of what would be the norm, if you will. You know, white folks tell us all the time that, you know, you Negroes need to understand what the norm is. You need to understand how the rules of engagement are applied, et cetera. And I always say to them, yes, sir, boss. You know, I know, boss, it's a black man, old black man. You know, I understand, boss, what it is you expect from us. If you believe it, then you believe there are three moons in the skies overlooking planet Earth. But the judge rejected what Earl Grey was to say when he started talking about competency, and the judge, understanding there were only a couple of persons of color in the jury pool, because here in Minnesota, if you get in a case of any nature, more than two people black on a jury, if you will, man, all of the defendants must be black and must have committed crimes against other, we're lucky to get three people on grand juries. I mean, state or federal, if you will. And by the way, federal juries aren't much better than this state. And one of the reasons is the pools. And no one has talked to it since we had a series of hearings by the state Supreme Court over 20-some years ago. Does anyone talk in terms of how many African-Americans are dismissed from the pools and the rolls, if you will, before their names are even put in to whatever the little gadget is that they use? Though now what they do is allegedly use computers, which my sources have told me for a number of years are easily tampered with. And, of course, we understand how vulnerable we are as institutions after what Vladimir Putin has done to the United States of America and interfered in the presidential election of 2016. If you are a black person in Minnesota and you are expecting to be selected for jury duty, if you will, or certainly being selected to at least be examined for jury duty, and the person, working the computer and et cetera happens to see your name and decides that you, the Negro that lives across the street from him, and they don't like you, and they just purge your name. And let me say the reason that I'm so assured and reassured within my own self. I've been met all of the, and I'm a 78-year-old African-American, I have met all of the prerequisites since I became eligible to vote in 1960. But because I'm a well-known person, a controversial person, but have never been in the penitentiary, have never committed treason against the United States of America, have never done anything to quote-unquote threaten the security of the nation and et cetera, I have never been called for jury duty in the state of Minnesota. And 20 years ago, I actually testified before that same Supreme Court panel that was brought together by the then Chief Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court, because us black folk were complaining about the fact that, and there's basically only three counties where there would even be a chance for us to be on, and that would be Hennepin, Ramsey, and St. Louis County, where the municipality of Duluth is. At the particular time in question, there weren't any black folks being called, as they like to say, called for jury duty in Anoka County, which is a big white county just north of the major metropolitan area. So anyways, years ago, at that time I was the chairman of the Minneapolis Urban League, member of the NAACP, and also chairman of the Civil Rights Commission of my city here, Minneapolis, if you will. And I actually was able, working with a couple of other folks and some young black lawyers, we finally got the white folks to at least hold a public hearing. In fact, for those trying to authenticate, if you will, it was held in the grand jury room of the government center in our beloved downtown Minneapolis, if you will. And it was run in an appropriate way. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court presided. That's how important it was. Legislature was given every chance to correct it and et cetera. And by the way, we don't have any elected black officers or officials here in Minnesota. We've got two black senators. We've got a black representative. The two senators are out of the city of Minneapolis. One's on the north side, the other's on the south side. I take that back. That's right. We do have now a Somali representative who was just elected. I apologize. So we have three in Minneapolis, and we still have a single state representative out of St. Paul. And so we have four. There's four of us. for people of color who are along the lines of Afro, if you will, you know, African-Americans, African or Afro, Somali, etc. But it still proportionally has not improved, if you will. Black folks still don't get on the jury. So now we go all the way back to Michelle Gross. And her, and I would suggest for some of those of you that like to go online and call this stuff up, her complaint should be posted on the Internet, if you will. You are certainly welcome, if you will, to check it, to examine it, and to take a look at a white woman, who recognized racism in its ugliest form, because part of what she talks about is the harassment and the insulting conduct by the attorneys for Officer Yanis during that preliminary part of the trial where one is selecting jurors to serve and meet the requirements of justice. Notice what we said, to serve and to meet the requirements of justice. Now, all of this, my friends, ties in to what we started out talking about at the very beginning of this program, the mental health of Black America and the conflict that unfortunately comes with those who are charged and have been charged since the days of slavery with enforcing and managing, notice the word we use, managing the conduct of the Negro, if you will. Now, managing conduct, if you will, in a society that is as violent prone as America, indicating that this access to this place called North America was done by force of arms, was done by treachery, if you will, was done by collusion and treason and et cetera, and certainly led to the death of millions and millions of indigenous people that are now referred to as Indians, because the idiot who landed, and he never landed on the shores of the continental United States, he landed on an island off the coast of, they say, Florida. No one really knows. You know, white folks just make up stuff and declare it to be authentic history, and we're all supposed to live with that. But the fact of the matter was that the millions of Native Americans who were murdered, killed, violated, genocide against, and et cetera, was all a part of building, and this has become popular also, fake news. Well, we need to also talk about fake history, because that today was what two excellent Black researchers, yes, Black, I mean, I have to tell you, as I said earlier on this program, you know, 28 minutes ago, I was impressed. I was extremely impressed. I had not seen anyone like these two ladies lay it out like they did since my days at the University of Syracuse, which was a long, long time ago. Would you like to believe 1965 and 66 at the Alinsky School of Political Science and the Maxwell School of Political Affairs, if you will. For years and years, I had watched as white researchers enunciate, discuss, provide, if you will, incorporate, penetrate, and et cetera, their theory of the Negro situation, if you will. Now, that includes a gamut of everything. It includes, you know, the judiciary. It includes the economics, if you will. It includes health. God knows it includes health after what we went through with things like Tuskegee and, you know, HIV and et cetera. We, the sons and daughters of the African, know that we are always experimental food, quote unquote, for those who get big money. They get big grants. And so it was interesting, with great specificity and detail, this afternoon at Minneapolis Urban League from 2 to 5. These two one African-American, one from Cameroon, laid out with, again, we repeat the word, with detail and specificity, just how this country operates and how this country, if not for the strength of the sons and daughters of the African, they would have driven we black people into the insane asylum, in fact. And that's what one of the researchers said. And we sat there with great fascination at, and these are young women, if you will, you know, women get upset, which very much in their early 40s, if you will. One from the University of Minnesota, another one from Lehigh. Now, the professor from the University of Minnesota, Professor Rachel Hardiman, a year ago, about this time, printed one of the most outstanding reflections on what was happening with regards to relationships between communities of the African-American persuasion and law enforcement in the New England Medical Journal, if you will. And it was interesting because she was asked the question by a member of the audience on what was the response of her colleagues and peers at the University of Minnesota and other places around the country. And her answer was rather interesting, if you will. I do believe that the Urban League taped the meeting and the presentation. I'm fairly sure that they did. There were certainly enough electronic devices in the room. But the articulation that was brought forward, the clarity, and that's always so important, because white folks always, oftentimes say that we black people lack tea, that we're not able to express, if you will. We don't have the intellectual continuity to talk about those things that white folks, quote unquote, know, understand, and oftentimes behind our backs will indicate that they were the ones that perfected the particular language, if you will, the references, the point of references, and et cetera. And so consequently, that makes the Negro unqualified. As the white attorney was actually saying in the court, in the Castile case, when he was asking the young 18-year-old Ethiopian to indicate the judicial structure of America, if you will, and she did, and the white man didn't like it, if you will, and she was asked to leave the courtroom until the judge ruled on the motion. Oh, yeah, we're going back to it because it all entails the beauty of what these two black female researchers provided to a small group, 45 in number, called the Urban League of Minneapolis in North Minneapolis from 2 to 5 this afternoon. And one of the things that came out, and it's in the article for those of you that have taken the time to get onto your little mouse and to try to find the article in today's edition of the Star Tribune. The prosecutor in this particular case, as I think many know, of course, was the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, who the county attorney, elected by the general population eligible to vote, is Asian, Mr. Choi, if you will. And one of the attorneys actually handling the case, a Mr. Zuckhofer or something like that, protested immediately, and he hit on the right point because what he said, and man, this was a strong point made by Ms. Gross in her ethics complaint against Mr. Gray filed yesterday here in the state of Minnesota, was that this white lawyer had not asked a single other individual, white, repeated again, white, he had not asked them the same series of questions, and he made a mistake. Mr. Gray made a mistake, and this is mostly a brilliant white barrister, if you will, you know, and because he said that any 18-year-old should have been able to answer the questions that he put forward. The only problem was the judge recognized the code language that was going on. What Earl was really saying is that this woman should have recognized these questions because any 18-year-old white person, male or female, college student, would have recognized the inquiry that he was making, the posing of the questions that he had posed. Your understanding of the criminal justice system, what do you know the difference between a misdemeanor and, quote-unquote, a felony and such things? That, well, as Ms. Gross pointed out in her affidavit and her complaint to the committee here in our beloved state of Minnesota, those are questions that you are not allowed to ask unless, this is something white folks always tell us as it pertains to how the system works, unless you have laid the foundation for the purposes of these questions so that you eliminate the issue of a frivolous inquiry, if you will. And old Judge Leary up there, that's the judge's name, the old judge, well, he's not that old, actually, probably in his early 50s, he recognized that Gray had left him, the judge, no room to purge what was at that time one of only two persons of color that was still left. There was a African American male young man who was still there, and he was to ultimately be set on the jury, which gave them a jury of 10 whites and two persons of color, if you will, whoopee for Minnesota. And so when Mr. Gray raised the question about the competency of this 18-year-old woman, this woman from Ethiopia, if you will, probably came the same route almost, though she probably flew that old Earl's people came when they came over here from, if that's really his last name, if that was really the name of his great-great-granddaddy and et cetera, or if they changed it, if you will, so many white Americans, as many of us in black America know, do not live under the names that they were originally born with or part of their family lineage, if you will, going back 5, 6, 7, 8 generations, if you will. Now, that was a part of the driving force this afternoon at the Urban League, that these two black researchers, well-grounded, if you will, in their knowledge, their interpretation, their expression. And I'll be doggone in the course of kind of a Q&A, a number of other, particularly young black women, began to be drawn into the discussion, and they began to ask the right kinds of questions, my friends, that reinforced what these two African-American, these two women of color brought to the table. And then later, the sister from Lehigh University in Pennsylvania, Lehigh, Pennsylvania, was asked about a particular writing she had been involved in. Professor Hardiman had absolutely clarified that she had written a piece that the definition that was used by the New England Journal of Medicine was a reflection and series of statements that the New England Journal, which is really very conservative on the issue of race, had never really used before. Maybe had used in 125, 130 years. I'm not sure. Later, the researcher from Lehigh was asked a specific question about some writing that she had done and materials that she had brought forward. And she talked in terms of a particular piece that she had written in which she raised questions about police misconduct, police brutality, and things like that. And the president of her university had received a nasty email from probably some neo-Nazi out there with my buddies out there in Spirit Lake, in northern Idaho, if you will, and, you know, called her a savage, you know what I mean, said she was unqualified to even express an opinion, that she sounded like a gorilla, you know, an ape, et cetera. Now, a question was asked again by a person that was asking a series of questions of the two researchers, if the president of the college had responded in such a manner to protect the academic freedom, if you will, of one of, quote-unquote, his professors, And by the way, this, so for absolute clarity, she is an assistant professor, as is Professor Hardiman, who is both our assistant professors, and have worked closely, though, with the University of Minnesota, you know, which is, you know, just a marginally a little bit above racism or racist institution. But, what the heck, you know, you got to live with what you got to live with. I mean, that's at least what you tell yourself. But again, I hope that the Urban League of Minneapolis recorded, or has certainly recorded with permission of the two researchers, because researchers, and rightly so, are very guarded about the work that they do, because there is so much plagiarism that goes on in academia and et cetera that one has to protect the heck out of their work product and et cetera. But it was the tone that these two lovely ladies, these two black researchers, set that really got the crowd, if you will, the group of African Americans and a sprinkling of whites, fully engaged, if you will. And so the Urban League of Minneapolis, under Steve Belton, is to be commended for taking the opportunity to address a very, very, very serious problem, a life and death problem here in our beloved Shangri-La, the city of Minneapolis, along with the city of St. Paul at the headwaters of the Mississippi. Now, the reason that I have this evening put additional emphasis on that as we go into the last 17 minutes of tonight's program was that I was so disappointed. And we said right at the top of this program, irrespective of what folks may think, we are a calculating commentator, very calculating. And we had said at the very top that there was a lot of money being passed around by the city of Minneapolis, and even more with regards to the second round of funding from the Bloomberg Foundation. A $5 million grant was given to the city of Minneapolis at the very end of 2015. Funding began around June 1st of 2016, maybe even earlier from what we've been seeing with regards to who it is that got money to allegedly deal with the problem of violence and et cetera. In the meanwhile, though, a deal was cut with Hennepin County, which is the county in which we here in Minneapolis exist within, and a facility which actually is just a block away from the Urban League, and then with the University of Minnesota, which also has a facility just a block away from the Urban League. In other words, the Urban League is caught in the middle. Both organizations, the UROC, University of Minnesota Research Offices, if you will, they do a lot of experimenting on black people at UROC. Nobody's supposed to talk about it. And then the county's facility, now referred to as North Point, actually was founded under the legislative provisions in the 1960s of model cities and pilot city, if you will. What has basically happened is that the county on one side and the University of Minnesota have taken control of a very lucrative, very, very lucrative process, grant process, and et cetera, to begin to examine and prepare for detention, incarceration, the African-American population in the city of Minneapolis. It was first brought out by the then mayor of the city of Minneapolis, a man by the name of R.T. Ryback, who now is the head of one of the largest foundations in the state of Minnesota, the Minneapolis Foundation, if you will. He has just upgraded his diversity by appointing as his number two person a African-American woman who had then the administrative head of what was the largest nonprofit social service agency in the city of Minneapolis, but is having some financial problems and is having terrible problems in its relationship with the Somali community in an area known as Little Mogadishu, and specifically Cedar Riverside, if you will. For those that are continuous listeners to this program, you know just what we're talking about. But what has happened, this second round of funding, FY2, the $1 million there, it will be allocated for the institutions, if you will, government institutions, to now escalate the necessary programs and ultimate detention, if you will, cooperation with authorities and et cetera. In fact, it is rumored, if you will, and this was discussed in a meeting in February in North Minneapolis, that a special court will be set up, if you will, to deal with the mental health situation, similar to how the courts deal with sexual predators here in the state of Minnesota, in which, in fact, a federal judge has the case right now trying to make a determination. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, it's on appeal because the judge said, you know, it's unconstitutional. I mean, you send a man to 20 years and he gets out and you tell him that the rest of his life will have to be spent incarcerated until the time of his death because he is a sexual predator. Well, I got to tell you, my friend, we're listening to this program tonight from the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, particularly on the occasion of a excellent and stimulating patient by two black researchers who knew what they were talking about and who had no problem whatsoever for providing reflections that talked about the need for the African-American community to begin to prepare themselves for what is coming. And so with the development of a special court, kind of sounds like one of the banana countries, doesn't it? Or, you know, maybe some oppressive dictator or Vladimir Putin. Vladimir Putin. I bet you Vladimir Putin could convince his good friend Donald Trump Sr., you know, or maybe even Jr., to begin to have their attorney general, the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan of Alabama, Jeff Sessions. I know that makes some of y'all upset out there, but I know there are others that you're doing your homework, man, because when he had his confirmation hearing, Jeff Sessions really was not asked the kind of questions he needed to be asked about his role as a young white man in Alabama before he got into the federal system. He started out, of course, as one of those Ku Klux Klansmen working within state government, starting normally at the county level, if you will, making sure of voter suppression of the Negro who would dare make an attempt to vote in some of those counties in Alabama. Yeah, Jeff Sessions, Jeff Odegaard Sessions, if you will. The reason that we have just reflected on that in the last minute and a half is because these are some of the things that these black researchers talked about in a landmark presentation at the Urban League of Minneapolis in this city, if you will. And yet we have to say that there was not a single representative of city government for the city of Minneapolis in this meeting, researchers from the University of Minnesota and from Lehigh University talked in terms of the dangers and how the two issues, clinical issues of police activity and relationship and mental health had unfortunately came together a long time ago and was a part of the emotional and intellectual bleeding that is taking place in the United States of America. And yet there was not a single government official. The councilman, who himself is Asian, concerned, if you will, was not there, nor was there a single remaining 12 members, if you will. But more importantly, the entity under colored law that handles the distribution of the monies to some of the most unqualified people that I've ever seen. I've been here a long time, my friends. I've been here since 1945, and I've been an activist since 1958. And I'm looking at the incompetency. But then today, when given an opportunity to hear from individuals that are boots on the ground, that know and have lived, if you will, the experience both domestically, internationally, you see, that's a rarity, man. You know, for those of y'all that are out there, if you will, of the black experience, of the black race, et cetera, and whoever our supporters may be, that is a rare experience in the world of research, if you will. And yet, these two ladies giving this excellent presentation, there's not a single person from the executive branch of government. No one came from the mayor's office. There's a woman by the name of Sasha Cotton. Yes, Ms. Cotton, we have to name you tonight over the air across the world, who has been handing out the money, which is doing a great disservice, quote unquote, to the facilitation and any attempt at a continental help and police community relations and police misconduct and police brutality. The administrative assistant, Nicole Archibald, a woman who says that she sits as the supreme funder, quote unquote, on behalf of the executive branch of government and for the mayor of the city of Minneapolis, if you will. The head of the GBI program, the Gang Violence Initiative, because that's really what it is, and others. Now, the young African-American, or I'm not quite sure, but black woman, who was the moderator, the head of another program that has dealt with how additional monies will be spent in the area of dealing with the Negro problem, and et cetera. Now, earlier in this reflection dissertation, I mentioned the name of R.T. Ryback, former mayor, three-term mayor of the city of Minneapolis, a man who despises black people. In fact, upon his election, but 14 years ago, indicated that he would do everything in his power to change the face of black leadership in Minneapolis and create nothing but pain for the black population. And he began to do that. And in 2009, he presented an interesting position paper put together by an all-white committee that he appointed back in 2005, which made recommendations on how to begin to divest the city of Minneapolis of its black population. Yes, divest it will make black folk begin to disappear. An all-white, powerful, powerful business-oriented group worked for a couple of years, and the mayor of our city at that time presented this to the conference of mayors, if you will. He said, we have the plan. We are developing the plan for actions of genocide against the African-American population in my city. This is the mayor at that time, R.T. Ryback, now the head of the Minneapolis Foundation, one of the most powerful foundations in the United States of America, if you will. They should have been there, but they knew that they could not afford to be there, because as we close, as we come to an end of tonight's program, there was discussion at some level in different enclaves, if you will, which included some African-American leaders, if you will, who also were nowhere to be seen, that the R.T. Ryback Manifesto of 2009 was the answer. Now, it's taken them almost a decade to put in place the mechanisms, including, quote-unquote, a supervisory court They will begin to process those young African-American men and women who will find themselves, unfortunately, in the criminal justice system. So that's why tonight in our city, it was so important that two extremely qualified African-Americans, well, from the nation of Cameroon, should not have had a packed room of movers and shakers to hear what this conflict is all about. Everybody pretends that they want to know why there is conflict between the police on one hand and black people and others of color, and et cetera. The documentation is there. In fact, one of the most astute examinations of the problem, besides the FBI, Federal Bureau of Investigation, has been the very powerful Police Research Institute under Chuck Wexler. Mr. Wexler, who has international credentials as it pertains to his knowledge and understanding of policing, community policing, or any kind of other policing, etc. And yet, there has been no attempt or effort to reach out to, if you will, even though the current chief of the police department in Minneapolis is a member of the board of directors, but advice was coming from powerful, powerful corporate interests led by the Minneapolis Foundation that said, we want to control what kind of reflections, what kind of discussions, what kind of recommendations are made, and we want nothing to go outside of the King Alfred Plan of 1962, the King Arthur Plan of 1968/69, and the Ryback Plan of 2009. For those of you that are interested, go look for it. King Alfred Plan came out of the Department of Justice in 1962, talks in terms of the incarceration and roundup of millions of African Americans. The King Arthur Plan was developed by a former sitting district court judge, now deceased, but a man that was so smooth with regards to how he talked about eliminating the Negro problem. We in the African American community were able to beat that plan down, but they had already started building detention centers and facilities. By the way, that same type of plan is in place now. We have a nice private prison that went bankrupt. I don't know why as many black folks are being put in jail in this country. There should be no wanting for quote-unquote tenants, if you will. But we have a prison here, a private prison that went out of business a couple of years ago. It's now under consideration and being looked at as a facility that will hold quote-unquote the first wave of those people that will be sent in that direction. University of Minnesota is in on the game through a legendary figure in the book entitled Medical Apartheid, which we will begin to talk about next week on this program. Keep it in mind, medical apartheid, it tells how to get the job done. Well, we appreciate the opportunity to come to you again, my friend, internationally, domestically, locally. But this afternoon at the Minneapolis Urban League, two of the greatest minds as it pertains to research and the survival of the African American were present. And there weren't any government officials there except for Commander Charles Adams of the Minneapolis Police Department, a commitment by Chief Janae Harto to try to stem some of the tide. God bless you, Black America. Bless you, Black Metropolitans and St. Paulites, if you will, because the big juggernaut is on the move. The plan is in place, and a decision was made today to ignore a great message of sincere and factual and actual research. Again, God bless you. I'm Ron Edwards. We'll be back next week. Good night.